Hello, I'm Dr. Stuart Goldberg from the John Thor Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey, and I'm here with ManagingMDS.com. Today we're going to talk about what's new and what's on the horizon in myelodysplastic syndromes. And I'm joined today by one of the true experts in the field.
Hi, my name is Azra Raza, and I'm Professor of Medicine and Director of the MDS Center at Columbia University in New York.
Well, let's start with a case. I recently saw a 73-year-old gentleman who presented with fatigue and chronic dyspnea. His past medical history was significant for mild coronary artery disease, and he was on a beta blocker and some aspirin. He saw his family doctor, who noted that he had a macrocytic anemia with a normal white count and a normal differential and a normal platelet count. His renal function, hepatic function, and vitamin studies were all normal. He had a slightly elevated erythropoietin level, and his ferritin was slightly elevated upon presentation. He was sent to me for analysis of his macrocytic anemia, and we performed a bone marrow study, which revealed changes consistent with a low-grade myelodysplastic syndrome, refractory anemia, in the FAB classification system. He had no blasting and normal cytogenetics. His IPSS score was a low risk, and his revised IPSS score was also low risk. Dr. Raza, could you explain to our audience a little about the new classification systems, especially focus on the RIPSS system?
Yes. So when a patient walks into our office with myelodysplastic syndromes, the first thing we want to know is really if the patient has a chance of living for 10 years or is their life at risk in 10 months. And this sort of distinction has been made traditionally by using the International Prognostic Scoring System, or IPSS. But over the last 15 years, it was recognized that there were some issues in terms of accuracy of predicting prognosis with this system. So attempts have been made to revise and refine some of the parameters that have been used to segregate patients into various risk categories, and that system was reported in 2012 in Blood, and it is called the revised IPSS scoring system. So the original scoring system took into account three parameters. Number one, what are the cytogenetics? Number two, what was the percentage of blasts? And number three, how many blood counts are low? In the revised IPSS system, the same three parameters are looked at, but in slightly more elaborate and greater detail. So, for example, in terms of cytogenetics, we now have divided them into multiple categories, which are presented here, ranging from very good prognostic categories to a very poor one. And these are all described in detail here, along with how the median survival of patients varies from 5.4 years of median in the very good risk group to a very poor prognostic group, which is 0.7 years total survival. Similarly, the percentage of blast has been divided, and so have not just the number of cytopenias, but the profundity of each cytopenia. So, for example, was the hemoglobin less than 8 grams, or was it more than 8 grams? What about platelets? Were they more than 50,000 or less? And ANC as well. And based on this revised IPSS system, we think that we have a slightly more accurate predictive ability. So a score is assigned to the patient and the risk of survival is given. But just remember that these are just median survivals for a large group of patients. So to apply this sort of thing to an individual patient can be a little tricky, and we still haven't reached the point where we would be able to predict with absolute accuracy what is the risk of transformation to AML and risk of death. And this particular slide that you put up, Stuart, shows nicely the time until 25% of patients develop AML in years. And you can see the huge difference between the very low and very high risk group, again underscoring the fact that MDS is a very heterogeneous disease.
Now, certainly we've learned a lot about cytogenetics and the classical karyotyping, But in the last 5 years, I know there's been a lot of advances in our understanding of the genomics, going beyond just the classical karyotype. I know as shown on this slide, there are now a number of different mutations that we see in myeloid malignancies, and they're starting to group in myelodysplasia and really even pointing characteristics of what might be treatment options. I know that your group has done a lot of this work, and maybe you could explain a little bit to our audience about MDS mutations and even the exciting work that came out of Dr. Bahar, how we can use this clinically to sort of figure out which might be the best treatment for our patients.
So we have known for many years that the hypomethylating drugs that affect epigenetic regulation appear to work best in patients who have myelodysplastic syndrome. And I think this slide really demonstrates why that is so, because the left lower quadrant shows the genes that are found to be affected. Mutated in MDS most commonly are those involved in epigenetic regulation. Specifically, TET2 gene is found to be mutated in up to 20% of the patients. And more recently, of course, in 2011, when unsupervised whole exome sequencing was performed, it was discovered to everyone's surprise that perhaps this most common group of genes that are found to be mutated in MDS are splicing factor genes. And the right bottom quadrant of this particular slide shows that splicing factor 3B1 is found to be mutated in 16% of MDS patients, but in 70% of RARS patients. And the interesting thing that's not shown on this slide but is true is that 98% of patients who will have SF3B1 mutation will have the presence of ring sideroblasts in their bone marrow. So SF3B1 is directly associated with ring sideroblasts whenever it is mutated. Now, going on to the next slide, something interesting that our group has done is looked at, well, we worked with Rafi Behar and Ben Ebert, and this paper was published in New England Journal of Medicine in 2011, where 439 patients with myelodysplastic syndromes and 200 normal controls were looked at, and it was found, interestingly, that if there were mutations in any one of the five genes which are listed in this yellow panel here, EZH2, P53, RUNX1, ASXL1, and ETV6, then survival is affected. So, for example, if there is no mutation, then survival is better than even if there's a mutation in a single one of these genes, as shown in the right upper hand quadrant. Then, if you look at the left lower quadrant, what you see is that if there is a low risk patient and there is a mutation present, then the survival is almost exactly the same as the survival for intermediate one risk disease. And when there is no mutation, then the survival is that of low risk disease. So, in other words, when there is a mutation present in any one of these five genes, then the survival according to IPS, the risk category of IPSS is moved up by one. So intermediate one with a mutation would become intermediate two risk disease. And I think that this is very important because, like you mentioned, we can now start to use this sort of genomic information along with cytogenetic information and clinical characteristics to better stratify patients into risk categories.
And I think it's also important to recognize for our viewers that these genomic profiles are available in commercial laboratories. So it's not just the researchers and academics that have the opportunity to do this, that most commercial laboratories are now offering these tests.
Another additional thing is that because there is 100% concordance between blood and bone marrow, these genomic tests can be performed from the peripheral blood. You don't need a bone marrow to look for these mutations.
I think that's a very important feature, that sometimes I see second opinions and they've done the sort of the standard chromosomes, they come out normal, and you're trying to do the IPSS or the IPSSR, and you're trying to make a decision of, do I start the treatment or not? Sometimes sending off the peripheral blood, rather than putting the patient through another bone marrow, that peripheral blood can tell you if there's a genomic mutation that upstages the patient and maybe pushes us to start treatment earlier or pushes us towards a bone marrow transplant or doing something that a little more aggressive. So let's turn to our case again. And what are the therapies that we're sort of used to, I would call today's treatment? So this gentleman had a low-grade MDS. His major problem was anemia. So we started him on erythropoietin using 40,000 units a week. And we gave it weekly for 12 weeks to see if he was going to respond. But unfortunately, his hemoglobin barely budged. We then added low-dose G-CSF to our cocktail, thinking that two growth factors might be better than one. And there's good data from the Scandinavians that we can see improvement in patients who've had a minimal response to EPO. But after that, our patient still was very anemic, still requiring transfusions. So we went ahead and used an off-label use of lenalidomide, 10 milligrams a day. His hemoglobin stabilized around 10 grams, although he needed an occasional unit of blood. Because he was continuing to need transfusions, we offered him iron chelation therapy. Now that's what we do today. But now I know Dr. Raza at the ASH meetings that were just held in San Francisco, there were a lot of exciting abstracts about new therapies and even changing some of the ways we think about treating the low-grade patient. So I was wondering if you could comment on some of the major findings at that meeting.
Yes, so one very important study that was presented was the use of lenalidomide in non-deletion 5q patients, and these patients were once again transfusion dependent, belonging to lower intermediate 1 risk MDS and unresponsive to erythroid stimulating agents. This was a large placebo-controlled trial in which 239 patients were entered, and specifically, what was found was that the most of the patients, as noted, were transfusion dependent, and it shows that patients who received the lenalidomide at 10 milligrams, there was a 26.9% of the patients achieved transfusion independence, whereas in the placebo group there was really nothing significant. So this study actually completely confirmed what was already reported back in 2008 from the Celgene 002 trial, which was also conducted in non-deletion 5q MDS patients and showed the 26% transfusion independence rate. So with this study exactly paralleling the results of transfusion independence, I think it will become very much more of a common practice, if not leading to FDA approval for this particular set of patients. But I think this was a very important study that was presented at the ASH meeting.
I know that many of our viewers commonly use lenalidomide off-label, and this study will probably give you some support if you have insurance questions. I know that we often will use lenalidomide for the non-5q minus patients, and now we have a randomized comparative trial that shows a benefit in that group. Treated with erythropoietin and didn't have a response. The question now is EPO the best growth factor for this disease? And I know that at the ASH meetings, and I know that in your own research, you've looked at new erythroid growth factors. Specifically, I know I've sent a couple patients over to you for ACE-001, Sotrovimab, and there was also a very early study on ACE-536. Could you explain these new growth factors to our audience?
Yes, so this is a very interesting novel class of agents that have been developed and that seem to affect erythroid differentiations in the much later stages So, for example, in the basophilic stage of early erythroblasts, that's where these growth factors work. And in reality, these are receptors that are fused with IgG at their intracellular end. So the extracellular domain of the receptor belongs to really the TGF-beta family of receptors, and that's a super family with over 40 ligands. So the receptor is able to bind the ligand, one of these 40 TGF-beta family members. But once the ligand is bound to the receptor, then because the intracellular domain is now replaced by an IgG molecule, so what happens is that the whole thing gets dragged to macrophages and the cell is removed. So what we are saying is that by giving these fusion proteins as working as ligand traps, we are able to have an anti-TGF-beta effect. And what was done initially was to develop these agents as bone morphogenic proteins. But in that setting, when it was given to myeloma patients, they found that many patients increased their hemoglobin levels to dramatic values, such as 17 and 18 grams of hemoglobin. And so it was then, of course, proposed that we should be giving it to for anemia patients. And the first study has been done in thalassemia patients, and then, of course, moved on to MDS. So ACE-011 is sotatercept, and ACE-536, which was just reported in this ASH meeting, is a recombinant fusion protein. And in this study, patients who were treated had an increase in mean hemoglobin level of more than 1.5 grams over 8 weeks. And patients actually can become transfusion independent. The ACE-536 study, which was reported at this ASH meeting, showed that 6 of 19 patients had more than 4 unit or 50% reduction in their transfusion requirements. And 5 of these 6 achieved RBC transfusion independence after 8 weeks during the study. So this is a very exciting new development, because here is an agent that is given subcutaneously every 3 weeks, very easy to give, really minimal side effects or very tolerable side effects, and appears to be decreasing transfusion requirements as well as patients developing complete transfusion independence in response to it. Even improvements in platelets and neutrophils were noted in this study. But the study is right now ongoing, and we hope will lead to a phase 3 trial very soon with both ACE-011 and ACE-536.
I think one of the studies that I was interested in is the relationship between chelation therapy and outcomes. I know it's been we've known that patients who receive blood transfusions often will build up iron in their critical organs. And the studies that I published a couple of years ago, we saw that patients who receive multiple transfusions had higher rates of developing cardiac disease, higher rates of diabetes. But we've never really been able to show in a prospective manner that using chelation therapy improves those outcomes, in part because we don't have a randomized trial. My colleagues, Dr. Lyons, looked at over 600 patients with low-risk MDS in a prospective manner, but in an observational fashion. Patients were not randomized. 271 patients were given chelation therapy, and 328 patients did not receive chelation therapy. The patients who were chelated were the ones who were receiving many more transfusions. And what they saw was that in these two groups of patients who had low-risk disease, the overall survival, as well as the time to developing leukemia, were both significantly improved in the group that received chelation therapy, even though they were both low IPSS at the time of entering the trial. We also saw that the patients who received chelation therapy had lower cardiovascular morbidities and mortalities, and the group that received the chelation therapy who had endocrine comorbidities also had improvement in their overall survival. So once again, not a prospective randomized trial, but in an observational study with a large group of patients, we're starting to get a hint that chelation therapy may affect the ability to control iron overload in critical organs and change the outcomes, clinical outcomes, for some of our patients. I think this was give support for those of you who believe in chelation therapy. I know it's still a controversial area in the world of MDS, but I think that this type of large study may push us a little bit more in that direction. So let me turn to another case. I saw another 76-year-old woman who came in with unexplained bruising. She had diabetes, and she was a professional photographer who had extensive toluene exposure. She also had a macrocytic anemia. She had a low ANC, a low white count with a few circulating blasts, and she had some moderate thrombocytopenia. Her bone marrow showed a higher grade MDS, an RAEB2, refractory anemic excess blast type 2, with 12% blasts, and her cytogenetics were a monosomy 7. Using the IPSS scoring system, the classical one that we are all familiar with, she had three lines of cytopenias, she had some blasts, and she had bad cytogenetics, so she fell into a high-risk category. And under the new IPSSR that Dr. Raz explained, she fell into the so-called very high-risk category because she was fairly cytopenic, she had a lot of blasts, and she had poor risk cytogenetics. So under today's treatment, for a patient with intermediate risk group 2 or high-risk disease, based on the AZA-001 trial, which is a category 1 recommendation, we would use 5-azacitidine 1 week per month. We know that there's a survival benefit for patients with intermediate and high-risk disease if we use a hypomethylating agent. At 6 months, however, after a good trial of this medication, she still had cytopenias and was requiring transfusions. We repeated the bone marrow at 6 months, and her blast had gone down slightly to 6%. Based on the AZA-001 trial, though, because she was not showing evidence of disease progression, we decided to continue her on 5-azacitidine, because in the AZA-001 trial, if you were stable, that is, with you were not showing evidence of true progression, you actually benefited from a standpoint of survival. We did talk to her about transplant, but she was older, a little frail. She decided not to to pursue that. Unfortunately, by 14 months into the treatment, her count started to falter and she developed pneumonia. And then at that point, she elected to pursue hospice. So Dr. Raza, this is a standard way to treat a higher risk patient. What were some of the newer things at ASH meetings about the higher risk patient?
High risk patients, especially very high risk patients, really require early aggressive intervention. If there is a transplant possibility, we transplant them. Of course, if transplant is not available, then as you mentioned, hypomethylating agents is the first way to go. But if that fails, then the next options so far are really limited to clinical trials. And some of the interesting results that were presented at this ASH meeting included combination trials. So for example, in this particular study from SWOG, azacitidine was given either alone or in combination with lenalidomide or in combination with vorinostat, which is an HDAC inhibitor. And 276 patients with a median age of 70 were entered in this trial. And interestingly, the overall response rate really was similar in all the three groups. The relapse-free survival seemed to be almost the same as well. And so were the febrile neutropenia rates. So the survival rates really were around 20 to 35%. For each of the groups. Now, another study that was presented is 88 patients are admitted in this phase 1 and 2 study of sequential azacitidine and then lenalidomide. Once again, higher risk patients or AML patients, and all of them received azacitidine for 5 days and lenalidomide administered orally for 5 or 10 days starting right after azacitidine finished. The confusing thing about this trial was that there were many, many subgroups where doses of lenalidomide were being tried, but in the entire cohort, the overall response rate was 35%, with a median survival of 33 weeks. However, even though that sounds quite discouraging, the one thing to note is that in the patients who responded, which was 31 of these 88 patients, the median overall survival has not been reached, and the follow-up time is already 57 weeks. So it seems that the response rate is about a third of the patients, but those who respond appear to be improving their survival. Then the next slide shows an interesting development in using a long-acting derivative of D-cytamine, SGI-110. In this study, which was restricted once again to intermediate high-risk MDS patients, 100 patients were entered in the trial, and 53 had relapsed refractory disease, whereas 49 were previously untreated. Patients received 5 days subcutaneously of SGI-110 at 60 milligrams per meter square or 90 milligrams per meter square. And the complete response rate was 19% versus 22% in the two dosing groups. For relapse and refractory patients, there was a 21% complete response rate. And for treatment naive patients, it was 14%. So in fact, it seems that patients who have previously received a hypomethylating agent, have relapsed and have refractory disease, can respond to SGI-110. Transfusion independence and platelet transfusion independence were both achieved in a substantial number of patients, 32% red cell transfusion independence and 24% platelet transfusion independence. And again, this is quite impressive. In addition, at this ASH meeting, once again, clofarabine with or without low-dose Ara-C was reported for higher-risk MDS relapse and refractory to hypomethylating agents. 52 patients were evaluable for response, and the overall response rate was 48%. The median duration of response was 12 months, and overall survival was 6.8 months, but survival for those patients who responded was a median of 16 months, actually. So clofarabine seems to be a very interesting and encouraging possibility for this very high-risk group of patients who have already failed hypomethylating drugs. Remember, the group that we are dealing with really does not have many options. So to have some of these options available, even through clinical trials right now, is quite encouraging.
For a brand new patient who walks in the door who has a high-grade MDS, based on the studies that you just showed us, would you combine a hypomethylating agent with either lenalidomide or with an HDAC inhibitor as part of your initial therapy? Or do you think that the SWOG study says that we should wait a little bit longer?
I think, unfortunately, what the SWOG study showed is that there is no difference whether you give the drug alone or in combination with either lenalidomide or vorinostat. So no, I think for a brand new patient who walks in the door, still the best treatment is a hypomethylating agent alone, first of all, and then if they fail that, then one of these possibilities that are being reported. And the most exciting one right now, we mentioned so far, is the SGI-110, because that seems to be effective. Even though it is a hypomethylating agent itself, it's just longer acting D-cytamine, yet it seems to be helping patients who have failed a previous hypomethylating therapy. So I think that that as long as a strategy is working, so hypomethylating agents and then followed by the longer acting hypomethylating agent, and then I would go to either a combination trial or completely different agent like rigosertib. And this particular randomized phase 3 study of rigosertib that was presented actually turned out to be a study that did not meet its primary endpoint, but there were some very interesting things that were presented. So this is a dual kinase inhibitor that is in this setting was given to patients who had high risk MDS in a 2-to-1 randomized study with the patients either receiving the drug or receiving best supportive care, and patients could also receive low dose ARA-C on this. What was found in the trial was that the median overall survival for the intent to treat population was not very different between the, not statistically different between the rigosertib arm and the best supportive care arm. However, amongst the 184 patients with primary hypomethylating agent failure, median overall survival was 8.6 months in the rigosertib arm and 5.3 months in the best supportive care arm. And this was statistically significant. So while the primary endpoint for the entire study was not met, it seems that patients who are primary HMA failure, so there's a difference between patients who are primary versus secondary HMA failures. Primary failures are those who never responded to the hypomethylating agent, and secondary failures are those who responded and then stopped responding. So for primary HMA failures, it's an interesting thing to see that rigosertib appears to be effective in a statistically significant way in this subgroup. And what it's suggesting is that patients who are failing hypomethylating agents really are primary failures, really need a completely different strategy of treatment, a strategy that's provided by this kinase inhibitor. So in this and in this sense, the subgroup of primary HMA failure had encouraging responses to hypomethylating agents.
So I know our center participated in that trial, and we found it a little cumbersome to have the patients with the IV continuous infusion. But I know that your center has been pioneering an oral version of rigosertib in patients with lower grade disease. The data hasn't been shown yet, but could you share us any insights that you have with this drug when it's given as an oral drug?
So far, the oral drug, Stuart, has mainly been restricted to patients who have had a lower risk disease and only in a phase 1 and a phase 2 trial. And in lower risk MDS patients, we have reported a response rate between 30 and 40% of transfusion independence. Especially, there seems to be some synergy with erythroid stimulating agents with rigosertib. So I do think that the oral drug presents a very nice alternate substitute for the cumbersome intravenous 72-hour infusion that's given through a pump. But so far, we don't have this drug tested in the setting really of higher risk MDS patients. I do think that if the in the next trial, it is shown that for the subgroup of patients with the primary HMA failures and high-risk MDS for whom rigosertib turns out to be the treatment of choice once they fail hypomethylating agents, then I do think that a trial of the oral agent compared to the intravenous agent will be very much desirable.
Well, one of my favorite drugs in the AML world has been an oral drug called sapecitabine, which is a nucleoside analog. And for those of you who are watching, there's a large randomized registration trial comparing sapecitabine against decitabine in the AML patient, the elderly patient. Hopefully, if that's, you know, that's on a regulatory pathway. But at the recent meetings, and we've heard a little bit about using this oral drug in patients with MDS that have been refractory to hypomethylating agents. So I know in this trial, which we participated in, we saw 63 patients who were randomized to a variety of different dosing strategies. And we did see some improvement in hematopoiesis in patients who had refractory to hypomethanes and control of the leukemia blasts, this being more of a leukemia-type drug. And that led to longer survivals than we might have predicted in a patient who was already refractory to a hypomethylating agent. So I guess to sort of summarize, the question is really what's on the horizon? In this conference, we've talked about some of the better prognostics scoring systems that are coming out and the role of genomic profiling. We've mentioned a little about erythroid growth factors. We all know that we've used lenalidomide in patients with 5q, and now there's some data in the non-5q setting. A little bit more about chelation therapy. Certainly for the high-risk patients, combination therapies or new formulations of hypomethane agents, and then truly new agents. And then obviously we don't want to forget transplantation, which we didn't cover. Dr. Raz, do you have any final comments on things that you think are going to be changing the way we track practice medicine for patients with MDS in the next 5 years or so?
I'd like to just make two points here, Stuart. One is that it's very discouraging to note that the last drug that was approved for the treatment of MDS was 10 years ago. And that has really, we don't see too many new strategies, completely novel strategies coming on board even now for myelodysplastic syndromes. But I think that the novel insights that are being developed into the genomics, for example, all these splicing factor mutations, all the new mutations in epigenetic genes that are being identified, and as agents are being developed, I think that in the next 5 to 6 years, we'll see quite a dramatic turnaround of this discouraging scenario. But the last point I do want to make here is that the IPSS scoring system, which gives us really not the risk of developing leukemia, but the risk of dying for a patient, is a very important point for our hematologists, our colleagues, to appreciate. That for very low and low risk MDS patients, the risk of leukemia is 17 to 20%. But for very high risk patients and high risk patients, it's not like 80 and 90%, it's still 35, 36%. So in other words, what I'm saying is that the patients are dying of MDS at a very rapid rate in high risk MDS. They still die of their disease. So their disease is MDS, which causes increasing profundity of cytopenias. And so I think that drugs have to be developed for high risk MDS that target the MDS clone rather than always worrying about how do we stop development of leukemia? That's only in a third of the patients. And I think the next 5, 6 years, you're going to start seeing that.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation on what's on the horizon in MDS. This is Dr. Stuart Goldberg with Dr. Raza for managingmds.com. For more information on this disease, check out the website.